This land is your land. This land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Daphna Farhead of the People Speak radio show. Here at the People, when the people speak, we make a difference. Our guest tonight is Scott Horton. He's the host of Anti-War Radio for Chaos Radio on 95.9 FM in Austin, Texas. He's also the host on in the same station, KUCR 88.3 FM in Riverside, California, and he is the editor of antiwar.com, or assistant editor, I'm sorry. Hello, Scott. Welcome to the show, and thank you for being with us tonight.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Antiwar.com, what are you trying to prove?
Well, I think it's pretty evident in the title right there that we have no fear that we might need to be pro-war in one of these or another coming up anytime soon. It's the age of American empire. It's the age of aggressive warfare. We start the wars around here. There's no question about that. We don't face the Spanish Armada trying to land their Marines on our East Coast or anything like that. Without fear or apology, we are anti-war, and we basically, the site is run by Plumline Libertarians, and we try to feature, of course, all the most important news in foreign policy from around the world every day, and also all the best viewpoints from left, right, Americans, foreigners, anybody else, as long as it's good anti-war stuff. That's our single issue. We think it's the most important issue of all.
Well, let me ask you, when you started antiwar.com, were you then a libertarian?
Well, it wasn't me. It was actually Eric Garris and Justin Raimondo first founded the site back in the 1990s in opposition to Bill Clinton's wars. And I fell in love with the site as soon as I first found it in 1999 during the Kosovo War. And Justin and Eric both have been longtime libertarians. I think Justin Raimondo has always been a libertarian. Eric Garris comes from the left, but has been a libertarian since the 70s. And so I fit pretty much right in with them, being a libertarian, but obsessed, really. Well, not but a libertarian and obsessed with foreign policy as the single most important issue. So, I pretty much fit in with the group there, I think.
Well, I agree with you on where our country's headed, but why did they keep calling it terror?
Well, it depends what exactly we're talking about when it comes to that. But, of course, I mean, you can tell just from the word that it's a glittering generality, right? It speaks vagary. It's about a fearful reaction to something that happened. That's the war that we're against, is the terror that we feel when something bad occurs, something like that. It doesn't really make sense. And, of course, it's not supposed to, or it's not supposed to be specific enough that we can, narrow down any definitive end to the thing. If we called it even the war on Al-Qaeda, that would make more sense than a war on terror. But even then, of course, everywhere we go, smashing things and killing people in the name of looking for Al-Qaeda, we simply create more of them everywhere we go. So even then, fighting a war against them doesn't seem to be the right policy. But if the war is against terror, well then, geez, I guess as long as Americans are cowards, we're going to be at war, and that's going to be a long, long time.
Well, I agree with you there. I'll tell you, it's like, I think that we've become the terrorists, have we not? We're terrorizing ourselves in this country.
Right. South Park did a joke like that. South Park did an episode where the terrorists attack our imagination, and we have to defend our imagination from these terrible terrorists.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And they have, and we have a very colorful imagination, code red and orange. And I'm waiting for Violet to show up and see what we're going to do. I wonder what kind of a code we're going to have for, or color code we're going to have for radiation poisoning now.
Yeah. Well, ultraviolet. Once there's another, and I think it's a matter of time, once there's another major terrorist attack in the United States and the next red alert is declared, I think all bets are off for our Bill of Rights. It's pretty much there in name only now anyway, but we still like to believe it's our tradition in the society. I think one or two major attacks, and like Tommy Frank said in an interview back in, I guess, 2004, we will have a military form of government in this society, because the Pentagon won't give up the empire, which is the cause of all the terrorist attacks, and so they'll just have to get rid of our freedom, since that's their excuse for us having these enemies.
You know, I don't know if you're aware, but I'm Palestinian-American, and as a Palestinian-American, we have an activist. I have a great deal of opportunity talking with a lot of activists in the area. And we have been discussing the recent events in Libya. First of all, I know that in a lot of your work, you have been consultant on a lot of the legalities behind war and things like that.
That's the other Scott Horton, the international human rights lawyer from Harper's. I'm just the radio show host from antiwar.com. I interview him all the time, though, because he really is the expert you say he is.
Oh, okay. what are we doing in Libya? And do you know anything about the true definition of a no-fly zone? I don't think it's bombing the hell out of the military, is it?
Well, yeah, I think it is. In fact, that's why Robert Gates, believe it or not, the Secretary of Defense, back a few weeks ago, before this thing got started, said, "Look, you know, there's no such thing as just a no-fly zone." And if you look at what happened in the first Gulf War, we just finished, mounting a major campaign against Saddam Hussein's military. And at the end, they let him keep his attack helicopters and let him put down the uprising that the Americans had encouraged, that George Bush Sr. had called for. And then after that, they used that as the excuse to go ahead and keep patrolling over Iraq and prevent Hussein from being able to extend his military control back over especially Kurdistan, but prevent him from using his planes to bomb in the south. But he didn't have any planes left. Most of them had been destroyed. The rest had flown off to Iran during the war. And then the no-fly zone was bombed in Iraq, according to the conservative estimate of journalist Jeremy Scahill, on average once every 3 days throughout the entire Clinton administration. They were bombing people there. The New York Times estimated once every other day we were bombing Iraq. So it was pretty clear from the moment they said we're going to intervene in Libya in any way, really, to protect the people, what they immediately meant was we have to wage a war to prevent Gaddafi from winning this civil war. If he wins, all the people are at risk again, and so the policy is regime change. Simple as that. You can't have a no-fly zone, just like Iraq. Can't have a no-fly zone without eventually pushing for a change of power in Baghdad or Tripoli. And that's where we're headed right now. If the rebels, which apparently, according to the New Yorker magazine, really only number 1,000 armed men, most of whom just run around in circles firing in the air and whatever, it's going to end up taking, if they can't topple Gaddafi themselves, it's going to take probably a European and or American invasion of Tripoli to dislodge him. I guess it's possible there will be a negotiated end, but do you think Muammar Gaddafi is going to negotiate his exit? I don't really think so. And in fact, the British have already tried to cut off that exit for him by saying if they ever do catch him, they're going to put him on trial for war crimes immediately. Well, now he has every incentive to simply fight to the end. If he ever was considering exile, they just cut off that opportunity for him. So, I'm not magic or anything, but I'm predicting a very long-term engagement here in Libya, including a regime change and purple-fingered elections and training up an army and the exact same nation-building terror war madness we've been living through for a decade now.
Well, you know, a number of years ago, and I've often talked about this, excuse me, Donald Rumsfeld had previously, before the attack on Iraq, had gone over and over, and a dozen times or so, I'd heard him say that it was not the intention of the United States military to destabilize the Middle East. Now, I swear I must have heard him say this 12 times. 3 days after the attack on Iraq, he was asked, he said, if he thought these actions were going to destabilize the Middle East. And he said, we must destabilize the Middle East. And then he went on to talk about regime change and everything, and he literally listed every single one of the Arab nations, the last one being Saudi Arabia. So it is absolutely a planned event. This isn't something that accidentally happened. I believe that the events of the Middle East have been nurtured by our government and by our military and by our troops and by our intervention in their lives. And yet at the same time, here we are. We put up these incredibly brutal and sadistic regimes in the first place. And now when the people are uprising and trying to put them down, we're applauding against the regimes. Don't you think we're sending a bit of a mixed message, Scott?
Yeah, of course. The whole thing is absolute hypocrisy. You know, when George Bush announced the democratic program for the Middle East, I mean, you're right. There were especially statements by the neoconservatives and others about and the Israelis, Ariel Sharon specifically called for war throughout the Middle East and named Libya for one target. But it was pretty obvious that their main focus was on Iraq, Iran, and Syria, the three dictatorships in the region that weren't under the control of the United States, or I guess in the case of Saddam Hussein, was no longer under the control of the United States. Well, same for Iran, too. Anyway, so but from in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Yemen, Oman, Bahrain, Kuwait, Jordan, all these dictatorships are ours, the UAE and I forgot one on the peninsula there. But anyway, all those dictatorships are ours, whether they call themselves president or whether they call themselves emir or king or whatever, they belong to us. And I think this is sort of just my own speculation, but I think that the intervention in Libya, that the main thing driving that was a conversation in the White House having to do with trying to get out ahead of these revolutions and get out ahead of this narrative that was so obvious to the people of the entire world, that Uncle Sam, which I hate that, the euphemism, the United States Empire, was the bad guy in every one of these revolutions. Hosni Mubarak, why is he your military dictator? Because we make him that way. And you know, I think the American people were finally catching on. And so they said, well, you know, Gaddafi's only ever bought a few billion dollars worth of weapons from us, and he's only been our friend again for a few years now. He's no Hosni Mubarak. We can go ahead in there and smash him and make it appear, at least to the American people, even if the world isn't buying it, that we're still Superman, we're still the good guy, and we come in and fight for the oppressed people against madmen like Gaddafi, and it's World War II all over again. America saves the world, and this kind of thing. But they certainly have no plans for regime change like that in Yemen or Bahrain, or they say now they're giving up on Saleh in Yemen, but of course, even if that's true, it's because there's no way to save him now. In Bahrain, they're perfectly happy to see the Saudis roll their tanks in there to help put down the revolution among the 70% supermajority population in that country, which, you know, is possibly a path to war with Iran eventually there. And then protests break out in Syria, and all of a sudden the Americans have all this lecturing to do for the Syrians and how the Syrian military ought to stand aside and let the revolution overthrow the Assad regime and whatever. It's pretty easy to figure out the rhyme and reason behind who America backs in the Middle East or not. You know, in fact, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mullen, was asked on, I forget if it was This Week or Face the Nation, one of those Sunday morning news shows 2 weeks ago, well, what is the difference between Libya and Bahrain? And he said, well, Bahrain is our very close ally. That's it. So, you know, when their monarchy murders people, that's perfectly fine. Everybody say it with me.
So if they're friends of ours and they kill their people, we're good with it. But if they're enemies,
just like it was perfectly fine for Saddam Hussein to murder all the Kurds in the Anfal campaign in the Reagan years. He was our guy then. And then they used the Amphal campaign against him in 03 as one of the excuses to invade the place.
Well, you know, it's an amazing conundrum that people actually believe what is happening. You know, what is interesting, and I agree with you, during the Clinton years, during the no-fly zone over Iraq, I had interviewed one of the vets against war, excuse me, and I asked him, I said, what was it that made you change? You actively engaged in this war, you signed up after 9/11, and now you're saying that you're against the Iraqi war. What was the moment that you changed? And he said, when I was bombing Iraq in the no-fly zone, and my leader, our president, was on the radio, and I was listening to him on the radio saying that we were going to exhaust all democratic process before we attacked, and I had already been finished attacking. He said, at that point, I realized what was going on. It was a lie. It had always been a lie. And I found that to be very interesting. So, yeah, I do understand what you're saying when it comes to this no-fly zone is a war. You know,
yeah.
I was being
and you talk to any Army guy. Anybody talks to any Army guy they know who's a friend and a family friend or something, they'll go, well, you want to know something, and they'll tell you things that are not part of the story of American foreign policy the way they tell it on TV. I mean, you just grab an anecdote from an Army guy at random. And one more thing on that, which is there's a book called Invisible War by a woman named Joy Gordon that is worth its weight in platinum. It's about the entire program of sanctions and blockade and no-fly zone bombing in the 1990s leading up to the invasion of 2003. And it will absolutely blow your mind. It's so good.
So is it possible for the United States, assuming the worst possible scenario, and this is what I believe is eventually going to happen, they're going to engage the middle, either with Iran or with Syria. Under those circumstances, as thinly spread as we are, is it possible for America to accommodate so many wars?
No. No,
or
we have
one
a $14 trillion national debt. We got people are standing outside right now on the unemployment line as we speak, and their money is gone because it got spent killing Iraqis. You know, this is the price we pay. But it's, you know, a magical thing, actually, about having a Federal Reserve Bank is if you're a president, you can have a war, and you can have the Fed just print a ton of money and inflate a giant bubble, and everyone will feel like they're rich and feel like the war is going on for free. And then we all pay for it later through, you know, suffering what they're calling the Great Recession because they don't want to admit it's a depression. But then we don't connect the cost. We don't connect the price. We know that, you know, the Democrats are in power and I'm unemployed again or whatever like that. But we don't understand that this is the cost of that shock and awe that everybody loved so much back in 2003 when it was on TV. That's why they're unemployed.
Well, I'll tell you, I think that we're in a big kettle these days in the Middle East, that's for sure. What about this government shutting down on Friday?
Oh, I hope it does shut down and never reopens again.
I swear to God, Scott, that's what I said today. My brother-in-law was asking me, you know, do you think they're really going to shut down? I says, I sure hope so. I hope they shut down and never open again.
Yeah, we don't need a Washington, D.C. at all. You know, my friend Gordon Prather, he wrote for antiwar.com for years and years. He's retired now, but he was the former chief scientist of the Army and is an expert in nuclear weapons and debunking lies about Iran's nuclear program and such. And I was talking with him, and he was telling me about how it was in D.C. just back in the 1980s, you know, back in the good old days before things went absolutely crazy, I guess. And he was saying, no, listen, if you paid all these people just to stay home and let them keep the money, let these bureaucrats keep the money, but just send all of D.C. home, we would all be so much better off. Every decision they make is against our interests as the American people, you know?
But really, truly, what exactly happens when you shut a government down? I mean, does everybody just go home and wait for what? What is it that they're waiting for?
Well, they're surely not going to shut down the Pentagon. What it probably, in essence, means is that people who work for the Parks Department won't get their money. You know, that kind of thing. Eventually,
they
would go after entitlements.
You know, that must be what they call trickle down.
Yeah, but the DEA and the CIA and the FBI and the Pentagon, they all get to keep all of their budgets. Don't worry about them. The cops will be fine. The IRS, they're open tomorrow. Don't worry.
Oh, well, I'll tell you, I just laugh every time I think about it. And I guess, a couple of days ago, I was watching, looking up something online, and I ran across a chart. And in this chart, it showed the major expenditures of the American government today as it stands. And I was absolutely blown away by how little health care was an issue in our financial report. It said that basically it was less than 1.1% of the annual budget. That even something that I was very surprised at was foreign aid. Was like less than 6%, I think, of our national budget. Yet the issues of Social Security, the issues of Medicare and Medicaid, all of these things are, and the expenditures in the war take the largest chunks out of our budget to the tune of trillions of dollars, and nobody's talking about it. Why not?
Right. Well, very few anyway. Yeah, I mean, it's more than $1 trillion a year. And, you know, the way it works is, I guess, because it's just a democracy, in essence, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. And so if Lockheed works real hard to, sell their weapon systems to the Pentagon, and they run around creating things like the Committee to Expand NATO and the Committee to Liberate Iraq and the Committee to Rule the Middle East Forever and whatever, and they want to push for these kinds of foreign policies. Of course, they'll work with the Israeli lobby and whoever else they can to do it. They went out because they have that much money at stake. They're willing to spend a little bit on, relatively speaking, a very little bit, bribing congressmen, lobbying them and taking them out for steak dinners and whatever, buying them cocaine, that kind of thing. And then, spend a few tens of thousands of dollars a year on that and make billions in return. And the American people just can't compete with that. We're just not organized enough for that. The anti-war committee is poor and diffuse. And the war party is single-minded in their determination. They have no morality, no truth that they're beholden to, nothing at all. As Chalmers Johnson pointed out, these military industries will divide any single weapon system into different pieces being made in as many different congressional districts as possible, where you'll even have, like, I forgot which bomber it was. There was one of these bombers where a part was made in virtually every single congressional district in America, so that any congressman trying to withhold the money for this plane has to deal with the wrath of his constituents who are going to lose their jobs over it.
Really? That's fascinating. I had no idea that that's how they work that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so, we all lose, right? If your family, your neighborhood has a lot of people who have jobs making fighter planes and have good union jobs that pay real good to make fighter planes, ultimately that money had to come from somewhere. It had to come from somewhere else, from people who were working to make productive things, who got that money taxed away from them and diverted into making a plane that, yes, pays salaries to the people making it, but ultimately is useless. You can't use that plane to deliver other goods to market. You use that plane to drop high explosives on other property, a net loss for everyone involved. And so they sell us on this myth that war is good for the economy, but it's only good for the economy if you're Lockheed. For the rest of us, we suffer. That $1 trillion a year, more than $1 trillion a year now, is simply wasted. It's like George Orwell said in 1984, it's like taking the money and simply blasting it off into space or sinking it into the ocean where the people can't get to it, where they might use it in ways to make themselves more comfortable, more intelligent.
Got questions? The library's got answers. and books and magazines and CDs and videos and web access and databases and all sorts of other resources at your library. In a world that's information rich, libraries are information smart. Find the right answer and a whole lot more at your library.
This land is your land. This land is mine.
Join us on The People Speak for an hour of live interviews and audience interaction as guests from various organizations share their work and strategies which impact the world and make a difference. That's The People Speak every Tuesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Pacific, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern, here on the BBS Radio Network.
This land was made for you.
In a world of abundance, hunger is a crime. When a malnourished child dies, we're all guilty. Yet it happens every 5 seconds. Let's do the right thing. Put hunger away for good. Please, give to the world for the broken.
We teach them how to tie their shoes. They teach us how to live our lives. We teach them long division. They teach us how to bank online. Our children will always outgrow us. But for the first time in generations, they may not outlive us. Over the last 25 years, the percent of overweight children aged 6 to 11 has doubled. The percent of overweight teenagers tripled. Obesity kills. Heart disease, high blood pressure, diabetes, all are linked to obesity, a problem that could be greatly reduced just by having a place to exercise. Right now, people are working hard to put parks and playgrounds where children live, where children will use them. Finding out how you can help is as easy as tying your shoes. Log on to earthshare.org now, a public service message brought to you by EarthShare and the Ad Council.
Forever Fresh Disposable Undergarments offers a convenient, economic option to men and women who suffer from minor incontinence. Forever Fresh is a patented, internationally award-winning brand that allows the skin to breathe as naturally and comfortably as cotton garments. Environmentally friendly and hypoallergenic, the undergarment features a built-in incontinent pad pocket to be used when extra absorbency is needed. Forever Fresh is available at participating Walgreens. To learn more, you may also visit foreverfresh.com.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the People Speak Radio. We're back from our break, and our guest tonight, Scott Horton of antiwar.com and Chaos Radio. It's a pleasure having you with us. We've been talking about all kinds of stuff here. I have a couple of questions from some of our listeners. Scott, if that's okay with you, I'm going to read our first email from Atreides in the UK. Would it not be a good idea to let the folk who are intent on killing each other get on with it and kill each other? Maybe folk like you, Scott, should focus all your energy on building a new world away from violence.
Well, I mean, that sounds nice. I guess, you know, if I could order up the airstrikes and just drop all the warmongers on Libya from 10,000 feet, that would be some progress. Airstrikes starting with the 100 senators there, using them as DU rods. I think that'd be fair enough. But I'm not sure how to build a world, really. I just, you know, I'm stuck in this society with everybody else. And I think that this society could really be better, much better, if we could just let go of this militarism. We let the state convince us that it defines us. And I don't think that that's really true. You know, I think that, you know, I'm all in favor of expanding trade and exchanging, you know, ideas and symphony orchestras and all kinds of things with everybody all over the world. I just want to see an end to this imperialism. And after all, even if the public schools are right and foreigners aren't really human beings and it's okay to kill them all day, it still would come back to the economics of the thing. We can't afford to kill them all day, not anymore. It's cannibalism. We're destroying our own society while destroying others in the name of perfecting both. And it's just crazy. It's got to stop. And, you know, as far as building a more peaceful world, I suggest, you know, people go into business, trade with each other as much as they can. That's how to prevent war. That's, for example, what prevents war between the United States and China, is the billionaires in both countries have way too much at stake, you know. So I'm all in favor of that kind of thing. I'm not that entrepreneurial myself, I guess. But mostly, you know, I think my mission is to simply cast aspersions on the warfare state in America as it exists. They're just not legitimate at all. We're supposed to, for example, defer to the great presence of General David Petraeus. Well, I think he's scum, and I think he's a coward turning tail and cutting and running from Afghanistan with the mission not complete. And I think I really don't want to do anything but call him a pathetic, weak coward all day, because they want me to venerate him. They want our whole society to think that he's the best one of us. And, you know, frankly, I think he's the worst. I don't even think he's good at what it is his job is, which is killing people. If he was good at it, it wouldn't be much better. And I think that that's really what this society needs, is for somebody to kind of grab it by the shoulders like on that movie Airplane and just kind of shake us and snap us out of it, that, you know, this isn't all God, country, and good, true, and beautiful, and honor, and valor, and glory. This is an evil empire, like the kind the British used to have. And we're not supposed to have an empire. We're not supposed to be this way.
We're supposed to be a republic, and I believe everybody has forgotten that. Although, let me ask you this, Scott. You know, I see this bravado, this patriotism, this hoopla that's, you know, about being American and, you know, supporting our troops, and people are going to die for your right to say what you want to say and all that stuff. What does that mean exactly when we're going and stealing resources from other countries, killing people, when the people that have begged for 60 years, such as the Palestinians, for the United States to come to their aid, or at least stop aiding their enemies, and then they suddenly go and aid the Libyans? What does all that mean to us?
Well, you know, I mean, I think for the average American, the slogans are true enough, right? I mean, after all, the kid in the army is the kid from down the street, and we do wish him well, and we do want him to come home in one piece. And the politicians tell us that's all there is to it. When it comes to foreign policy, that's the only question, is do you or do you not love the soldiers? And that's a pretty good way to manipulate people. It's very effective. We've seen it, especially since, the Operation Yellow Ribbon back in 1991, where, as Robert Perry says, the great investigative reporter, he says that the main reason for that first Iraq war was just to exorcise those demons of what they called the Vietnam syndrome, wherein the American people decided they didn't like this anymore. They didn't want to have these no-win wars in faraway lands anymore. And they had to beat that. They had to change that mindset among the American people. And so and they just did a beautiful job, really. I don't know which all PR firms were involved. I'm sure the Rendon Group was in on it. And they just changed any argument about the policy to the troops. And do you or do you not support the troops? And so, you know, that really has worked for a long time. And one of my favorites is the one that you mentioned there. Well, you wouldn't even have the right to free speech if it wasn't for these soldiers. Well, that just doesn't make any sense, all right? The Japanese were never going to invade and conquer America and turn it into a Shinto fascist, subsection of the Japanese Empire wherein our freedom of speech was abolished. There never was a threat to the United States like that. Certainly not one that the army protected us from. Germany wasn't about to invade the East Coast. If we got into a war with the Soviets, they were just going to kill us all. It certainly wasn't the infantry keeping them at bay. It was hydrogen bombs. And so really any adult ought to be able to see right through that as just a ridiculous sports slogan. There's no substance to it whatsoever. It doesn't mean anything. We'd all be speaking Iraqi right now. We'd all have, an Ayatollah who takes our Bill of Rights away. But instead, we're losing our Bill of Rights because of this war. Every single bit of it, and including the First Amendment. And just over the weekend, Lindsey Graham was on TV saying that this pastor down in Florida who's burning Qurans, that he ought to be sanctioned, that he doesn't have the right to his own to destroy his own property, that he doesn't have the right to free speech, because after all, this is inflaming enemies against us. Meanwhile, Lindsey Graham is the same guy in the Senate who supports every war that anybody could think of to get us involved in, who supports indefinite detention and immunity and impunity for torturers and all the other things that really make Muslims around the world mad at us. But he would rather sacrifice the First Amendment and continue occupying Afghanistan, as though that's not the real problem that people are rioting over there. So, basically all this pro-war stuff comes down to, if you analyze any of it, it's all just one-dimensional sloganeering. There's no substance behind any of it.
Well, what are your thoughts on this guy that's burning the Quran? As a matter of fact, if I'm not mistaken, the good reverend is going to be coming and gracing the halls of Dearborn, Michigan, not far from, I live in Michigan, so at the big mosque. And I'd be lying if I didn't tell you that I was concerned, although we have a very, very moderate and wonderful group of Muslims that live in the area. But, boy, this guy's really pushing the envelope.
Yeah, well, but that's what the First Amendment is for. And, that's the whole thing about it, is it's, I mean, you just look at it simply as a property issue. It's his Quran. He can burn it on his property or on any public property or where he's not creating a fire hazard or on any property where he's invited to burn it. Really, the First Amendment is beside the point. And then also we got the First Amendment, which says that he's got the right to free speech. And even if he's out there saying America ought to be like neo-Nazi land, we ought to try to recreate the Germany of the 30s or whatever over here, he's allowed to do that. And then we're all allowed to boo him and tell him what an idiot he is. And, you know, all the Muslims of Dearborn, Michigan, are allowed to, be right there and prove exactly what it is about American Muslims that either is problematic or isn't, by their reaction to him. I think it's just like I'm always very proud to see it's always a Jewish civil liberties lawyer in New York somewhere who defends a neo-Nazi's right to say his madness out loud somehow, because of the First Amendment far outweighs any danger to our society from some Nazi spouting off.
And then, of course, a lot of our soldiers have died for his right to do that.
Well, as they say, indeed.
So there you go. Now you can get, there's just more to die for. I mean, I don't understand the mentality or the rationale, but.
And, here's the thing, too, is I don't think you should blame this pastor. I mean, he's an adult and he ought to be able to read and know better. But, he lives in a society where it is the common narrative, the accepted narrative, that the reason that we're in this mess is because Islam is such a bad religion that it mandates that its adherents hate things that are good and attack things that are good. And so here they hijacked our planes and crashed them into our buildings, and so we have to protect ourselves from their irrational madness. That's not just something that the fringe believes over at Newsmax.com. That's the lesson. That's the consensus of the Republican and Democratic parties and the entire foreign policy establishment of this country, is that the only explanation for terrorism against the United States is there's something about them Islams that makes them not right. And, like they're the Russians or something, they're this implacable enemy that we have to wage a generations-long conflict against. And there are so very few people in this society who are willing to stand up and say that that's just not true. America started it We didn't have to invade Iraq and stay in the Middle East after 1991, but we did. And so we got attacked on September 11th. It's like that. It's not that hard of a truth, you know, but on TV it is. MSNBC and CNN and Fox News and the rest of them, they will never be straight with the American people about this. So here's this Pastor Terry Jones who's going, well, if that's how you are, then I don't like your dumb religion, which makes him basically an average American, you know?
Which is, you know, it's interesting the way the media portrays certain things. I remember years ago during the first Intifada in Palestine and Israel, at the time, there were a lot, because of the nature of the conflict, and a lot of children were being killed by the Israelis, there were a lot of reporters in the region. During that period of time, what was said was that the majority of the reporters and journalists that were on the ground were on the side of the Palestinians because they witnessed it. But by the time they came back, the stories came back to the United States, suddenly it got an Israeli skew on it. And I always found that interesting. And they said that right on television. It's not like they were hiding it. So here we have journalists that say one thing and are pro one thing in another country. And when the word gets here, it's completely changed, completely altered. How do we trust our media?
Oh, well, I have no idea. I mean, you would think that they would all have had to just resign in disgrace by, I don't know, June 2003. Every single one of us got it wrong about Iraq. We all hereby collectively resign and turn the media over to the dissenters who were right, you would think, but no, not at all. It was, you know, it's a consensus of dunces. They all cover for each other. They all pretend that all serious people supported the war. If you were right about Iraq before it, it's only because you had some crazy, probably pro-Palestinian ideological bent or something is the only reason you knew better. Because all good, serious journalists were on board for the consensus. So they all got to keep their places, and the American people didn't really seem to object. I mean, I have no idea how anyone could turn on TV and see a politician telling a reporter who then turns around and reassures us that, yes, we're going to start another war to save the good little people of Libya now, and just buy that and not think immediately, wait a minute, I've heard this one before about we're invading a country in the Middle East because of how much we care about these people. I heard it from David Gregory before, and I don't believe him anymore. It shouldn't be that hard after what we've been through. But I don't know what it is. People,
it
they
is.
Want to believe, right? They want to believe.
Well, we have three more questions from guests, and I'm going to try to get in because this is just fascinating. Mike in California asked, recently Obama announced his run for the presidential reelection in 2012. I'm sorry. Who does Scott see as a viable peace candidate to oppose Obama?
Well, you know, if I had it my way, I'd like to see Dennis Kucinich challenge Obama in the Democratic primaries and attack him from the left on civil liberties, foreign policy, and bailout, welfare for billionaires issues. And I'd like to see Ron Paul on the Republican side win out with, you know, virtually the same platform as far as those things go. And then here's where I get crazy. I want for Dennis Kucinich to then, after mounting a very spirited campaign against Obama in the primaries, to switch to the Republican Party. I want to see Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich rename the Republican Party the Democratic Republicans, like Thomas Jefferson's very first party, which became the Democrats in opposition to the Federalists back in the days of Alexander Hamilton, and then kick all the warmongers and all the bailout mongers and all the police state mongers out of the Republican Party, and then we'll really have a two-party system in this country. Us,
Yahoo!
The people who want peace and freedom and no more corporate welfare, the good guys on one side, and the war party for taxation and tyranny and national suicide on the other. And then we can have, you know, Sarah Palin and Barack Obama can run together since they both believe the exact same things about everything important. And then we can have Ron Paul and Dennis Kucinich run together on the other side and change all this left-right nonsense from the way it is now and have a real realignment in this country about the things that are the most important of all. And again, peace, the Bill of Rights, and an end to corporate welfare. Now, I know that's crazy, and it'll never happen a million billion years, but that's what I want.
Like I said, Yahoo, a treatise in the UK, again, asks, what is Scott going to do about the end timers and the folk that believe that rapture who are powerful, have businesses all over the Middle East and even connected to Congress? These folks have an interest in making sure Armageddon happens. Note, Armageddon has not happened to validate their religion. It is self-fulfilling regardless of peacemakers. I'm not sure what exactly he meant by that last statement, but...
Well, I mean, he's certainly right that there's a big problem in this country with a certain segment of evangelical Christians, the post-millennialist dispensationalists, who think that... Mm-hmm. You know, they have the responsibility, I guess, either that or they're just sick and tired of waiting, and they're trying to force Jesus back to come back now on their timetable. I guess nobody wants to die alone. They want to take the whole world with them before they go. I think these people are a segment of power of the voting bloc that supports the Republican Party in this country. And yes, it's true that there are, you know, business relationships, that kind of thing, on the ground in the Middle East. Ultimately, I don't think that those people have too much influence over American foreign policy other than perhaps on
Israel.
The right, making sure that George Bush, for example, would not, you know, take Powell's advice and push for a deal about a Palestinian state. But as far as, you know, really getting us into Armageddon, something like that, I think they're a bit more marginal than that. And you know, I'm hopeful that as the calendar keeps clicking and as, you know, all the New Age people have egg on their face after their rapture doesn't occur in 2012, maybe we can get over this, you know, odometer syndrome about the calendar and get back to life, stop looking to Nostradamus and Mayan calendars and the Book of Revelations to find about our future. And get over it. I mean, hell, if there's a rapture, it already happened, and the real Christians are gone, and we're all stuck here with Pat Robertson and John Hagee.
Sheriff from New York wants to know, Scott, I'd like to hear Scott's comments about the recent capture of American Raymond Davis in Pakistan, who killed some civilians and claimed he was an American embassy employee. Doesn't the rest of America get it, that the Americans are evil in bombing Pakistan?
Well, no, I don't think the rest of the American people get it. I don't think they know very much about the war in Pakistan at all. Again, it comes back to the television, and they just really don't discuss those things that much on TV. But I would say that, you know, the story of this guy, Raymond Davis, is extremely important and extremely illustrative of the problem that we have. You know, he was apparently out on a meet and got attacked by somebody, killed a couple of guys. Then his rescuer ran over a guy trying in the van coming to get him. And this was a really big scandal in Pakistan. It led to major protests and this was before he was released. I'm not sure about the reaction to his release, but when it was just in the public about how they were negotiating his release. The people of Pakistan, at least a lot of them, came out and held huge protests about it, were very angry. And, you know, it's almost like a story out of a spy novel, right, where you have all these, you know, huge international players, these giant states and all this, intelligence agencies and whatever. But it comes down to the story of one guy, one day, causes a major change in the way things are perceived over there. And I think the Pakistani people in large measure just kind of seized on his personality as sort of the personification of American policy in Pakistan, which, you know, for the most part is robots flying around in the sky killing people. You know, some nearsighted guy in a lazy boy chair sitting in a base back in Nevada with the entire diameter of the earth as his shield. Is flying a robot around killing people over there. Even if they could shoot back at the thing, there's nobody even flying it. It's a very unfair fight over there. And people saw this guy, at least he's flesh and blood. They wanted to put their hands on him, but apparently he paid off enough blood money to the family that he was allowed to come home. But, you know, I think that's the kind of thing that should have, if the press, if the TV news especially, had been kind of honest about what was going on over there, I think the American people could have seen that, you know, the people of Pakistan are really sick and tired of getting bombed by us. And, in fact, I interviewed a former Pakistani general on my show today who said to me, "Hate you for your freedom. What bleeping freedom do you have? We hate you for destroying our freedom." And, of course, he went on to clarify he doesn't hate us, but he was speaking for the people of Pakistan. That's what they hate. He said he's been here, he has friends here, et cetera, et cetera. He didn't mean it like that, but he was saying, this is what's causing terrorism against you. This is what causes people to hate you, is you're bombing us. You're destroying our way of life over here. And the American people, you know, Pakistan might as well be the third moon of Saturn as far as they're concerned. You know, it might as well be an ant pile getting poisoned in the neighborhood or something, for all they care about it, for all they're told to care about it on TV. And so it's going to keep going on. And, you know, of course, the government over there has very little support. The military is basically the only thing holding that country together. And we're tearing it apart. I think it's probably just a matter of time until the Pakistani state falls apart, and then you'll hear Lindsey Graham and all these same people calling for intervention. We got to seize those nukes so that they don't get into the wrong hands. We got to do this and that to prevent a war breaking out between Pakistan and India, or who knows what. You know, it'd be their excuse for another intervention over there.
Yeah, again, terrorizing ourselves with our own imagination. Jack in Florida isn't the burning of the Quran by a notoriously publicized minister?
Oh, I'm sorry, you cut out there for a minute. I couldn't hear you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Jack in Florida asks, isn't the burning of a Quran by a notoriously publicized minister which set off riots in Afghanistan, and the burning of Obama's effigy akin to yelling fire when there is none in a theater and therefore a crime?
No, of course not. And yelling fire in a crowded theater has nothing to do with free speech. I mean, the question there is, whose theater is it? If you buy a ticket from a theater owner, then there's at least an implied contract there that you're going to act peacefully and not cause a stampede. If you do, you know, you're violating the conditions of you being a guest on someone else's property. And of course, that phrase, fire in a crowded theater, that's when your free speech crosses the line and all that. That comes from the prosecution of Eugene Debs, who gave a speech against conscription in World War I. That was the definition of yelling fire in a crowded theater, was that if you give a speech against conscription, then some guy might not want to be conscripted, and then the Kaiser could win. And so that's yelling fire in a crowded theater. And you see how the metaphor just doesn't hold. It doesn't hold to Libya, it doesn't hold to Afghanistan or anything else. This man, Terry Jones, is an American, and I don't mean he has great, you know, anything special about him for that.
I just mean, but he is an American.
I just mean he's subject to the law here is all, not to any other law. And he owns the property. He owns the book. He can burn as many Qurans as he wants. That's the end of it. I don't care if all of Afghanistan burns to the ground over it. And by the way, the reason that they're rioting in Afghanistan is because the Americans and their NATO allies are killing them over there. Burning their Quran is just insult to industry, to injury. That's just kicking dirt in their face after they're lying, you know, bleeding to death on the ground. That's why they're freaking out about the Quran. It's the war that they hate.
Honestly, I don't think anybody would have cared if anybody burned a Quran had we not been killing thousands and thousands of people.
No,
there.
Of course not.
Jerry in New Jersey wants to know, to what extent do you believe false flags have played a role in American foreign policy?
Well, it's pretty clear, I think, that FDR knew that the attack at Pearl Harbor was coming and deliberately withheld that information from the commanders at Hawaii in order to allow that attack to take place. I think one way or another, we've been lied into every war, whether it's, you know, deliberately sailing the Lusitania into waters that were known to be full of U-boats and calling off their destroyer escort, or pretending that there was a battle in the Gulf of Tonkin when it was found out pretty quickly that it was just an error and there really were no enemy boats. They went ahead and pretended that the thing was real anyway, that kind of thing. But, you know, I think mostly you know, on the individual casus belli, they'll lie about that. But I think that mostly the wars that we get in, if you'll look and see, you'll see it's mostly an attempt to clean up the mess that we made the last time we intervened somewhere. And that's pretty much an unbroken chain from, you know, Theodore Roosevelt, you know, messing around in the Pacific, you know, in the Philippine War and relations with Japan back then, through World War One, World War Two, the Cold War, and the terror war today. It's all blowback. It's all the unintended consequences of the last time. And of course, nobody in power is in power for more than a few years at a time, so they have an incentive to strike tough guy poses and then head out the door like we see David Petraeus doing right now. We'll all remember the Surge worked for the rest of our lives, no matter how bad he's actually failed, and he gets to quit while he's still ahead in the PR sense, you know? And
exactly.
So I think that basically that's the problem of empire, is just stumbling into disaster after disaster. And after a look at Libya right now, they didn't even need a false flag anything. All they had to do was say, well, we're preventing a massacre that could occur if we don't intervene. They didn't even have a pretended massacre like Kosovo. They were protecting us from a future one. And the same thing for the Iraq war. George Bush didn't need 9/11. He could have marched into Iraq anyway.
If we're going to preemptively attack nations of people, we may as well preemptively protect them, too. And on that note, we're going to call it a night. I'm afraid we've run out of time, Scott. It's been wonderful. You are just a barrel of information. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. We're going to call on you again soon. Thank you very much, everybody. That's it from the People Speak Radio. And don't ever forget, when the people speak, we make a difference. So keep on speaking.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the steeple by the relief office, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, and I stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream waters. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.